Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. We've got a great show for you today, our midsummer special. We brought in one of our favorite guests that we have back as often as possible. Dave Zirin will be here to talk about sports and media, the labor struggles in the NBA and the NFL, and a whole lot more. So it should be a terrific show. But before we go to our guests, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
When does a scandal turn into a national debate? When it reaches the upper echelons of power and exposes corruption of the political process. News Corp owner Rupert Murdoch testified before the British Parliament this week about allegations that some of his employees hacked the phones of thousands of people and bribed officials and police to cover it up. The scandal has led to the arrest of 10 people and took down the head of Dow Jones and News International, two of News Corp's largest subsidiaries. And it has snared Great Britain's Scotland Yard and the administration of Prime Minister David Cameron in a web of unethical and possibly criminal behavior. Mike Hoyt is the executive director of the Columbia Journalism Review. He says, in Britain, there's always been a culture of tabloid journalism. Hoyt sees nothing wrong with it as long as the newspapers stay within the law. But, he says, News Corp has gone further.
News Corp, a corporation with a tendency and a history of using journalistic power for its own ends, to accumulate more power and using journalistic power to, you know, intimidate politicians and regulators and even the police. That's pretty shocking, and it's an abuse of power.
In an ironic twist, the tables are now turned on Murdoch, who has always believed in the power of newspapers to shift social and political winds. The investigation into the phone hacking was started by a small British paper, The Guardian, in 2009.
It's good to remember that this whole thing started with a single reporter, you know, with a notebook and a computer and a lot of questions, and, you know, an editor who let him keep writing about it. And that's kind of heartening that good investigative journalism has that kind of power.
As Murdoch tries to minimize the story in Britain and his role in it, here in the United States, public interest groups, progressive activists, and some members of Congress are seizing the opportunity to call attention to the dangers of too much media in too few hands. Free Press President Craig Aaron.
I think that the real problem, the long-term problem, is the problem of too much media concentration, too much media power in one company. And it's really a collusion between those in power and the most powerful media companies, and that they begin to look out for each other and do special favors for each other. You know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. That's certainly been going on in England, and I don't think there's any question it's been going on in the United States as well. That's why U.S. regulators, who this year are going to be reviewing our media ownership rules again, that's why they cannot try to divorce this from what's happening in England. This is the same story.
There's a glaring digital divide in the nation's capital, and it's not because people lack access to the internet. Rather, many residents in Washington, D.C. are simply opting not to connect to broadband, according to a four-month study by the Investigative Reporting Workshop at American University. The study found that many populations are too financially strapped to pay for a broadband connection. Project Director John Dunbar says the debate over how to bridge the digital divide in America is becoming less about how to access the internet and more about how to pay for it.
It's a money issue. It's very much tied to income. The lower your income, the lower your adoption rate.
Dunbar warns that a broadband underclass is developing in America, as some populations soar with the fastest broadband connections available and others plod along with slow or no connections at all.
It's absolutely clear that if you don't have a good broadband connection, one that doesn't have, you know, restrictions on data, and one that you can load applications of your choice and be able to do things like heavy research and apply for jobs online and work on school projects, you're absolutely at a distinct disadvantage in this country. There's no question about it. And that gap between people who are hooked up and those people who aren't is going to continue to widen. It's a pretty frightening proposition. You're almost sort of looking at a broadband underclass.
Dunbar worries that the adoption problem could get worse, not better, as broadband prices increase and phone and cable companies refuse to offer plans for low-income communities. And with scant competition among providers in most communities, people have no choice but to pay high prices for broadband or stay unplugged. Convincing them that it's worth spending their limited resources on broadband is a conversation that Dunbar thinks is faltering. So what's the solution for this growing broadband underclass? Dunbar isn't entirely certain, but he does think it's become a civic issue.
It really does become a public policy local issue where should we, since the providers themselves aren't doing it, should we be using public dollars to install, you know, connections and access at a price that's closer to what people can afford or at least what they'll pay for? I think there's a really strong argument for that.
To read the full report, go to investigativereportingworkshop.com.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. Our guest today joining us on the phones from Washington, D.C. is the author, journalist, sports reporter Dave Zirin, who writes for The Nations, who has the Edge of Sports radio program on Sirius, is it, Dave?
Yeah, that's right, Sirius XM. They are merged now.
Sirius XM, good. I'm glad to see we have more mergers, just what this country needs. And also author of numerous books, including most recently Bad Sports, and the co-author of a new book, The John Carlos Story, written with the track legend and icon John Carlos, coming out in a few months. We'll be talking a little bit about that book, but I hope to have you both on the air in the fall when the book's formally released.
Definitely.
Give it the attention it deserves. Dave Zirin, let's get right at it. This, you know, I think you were on my show almost a year ago exactly, Dave. I don't know if you remember, right when Bad Sports came out. And you were talking, and you predicted that 2011 would be a year where there'd be a huge increase in labor coverage in the news media, specifically because there would be lockouts in the NBA and the NFL. And I think you meant it both that these were important stories on one hand, but also ironically that labor gets no news media coverage any longer unless it's sports unions that are involved.
Well, yeah, obviously I didn't predict what would happen in Madison, Wisconsin, which would increase the coverage of union issues, and that's been certainly very welcome. I think something that's been underreported is the degree to which people in the world of sports unions in particular, have supported those struggles in Wisconsin. Whether you're talking about members of the Green Bay Packers who issued statements of support or came out there among the demonstrators back in February, or whether you're talking about the Milwaukee Buck player rep Keon Dueling, as well as very strong statements from both sports unions. So it's been that kind of year. Now, when I said bad sports, how owners are ruining the games we love, I have to admit, even I didn't realize the degree to which owners would pursue a course where they would actually imperil the NFL and the NBA through just an unbelievable mission of obfuscation, greed, and accounting tricks that would make Enron blush.
You know, Dave Zirin, as you say that, you know, I've wondered, and we're going to go into detail on these for listeners who aren't really familiar with how these sports leagues work and how the union management relations have evolved. But sometimes I wonder just at the top that the owners in the NFL and the NBA, you know, simply are looking around the American economy and seeing private sector unions crushed almost everywhere except in a handful of industries. And, you know, even though they're making fine profits, they're saying, why the heck are we stuck with these guys? Why can't we junk our unions like everyone else?
No, there's a mentality among capital these days that reminds me of a scene from the movie Casino with Robert De Niro and Joe Pesci. I don't know if you saw that, but
of course,
De Niro talks about the mentality of a high roller who flies all the way in from Japan to play a baccarat, and about how the high roller wants to be conservative and just bet a little bit of money. But when he wins, he doesn't notice the money that he won. He thinks about the money that he should have if he had only bet the way he should have bet. And I think that's the way particularly NFL owners have been responding throughout this lockout. If they can't see the profits they have, they think about the extra profits that they should have. And I feel like that is such a short-term view of actually improving your product, of making your product a part of people's homes and lives, a cohesive part of communities. I mean, all these guys, I mean, they're much more Gordon Gekko than Walter O'Malley. And I can't stand Walter O'Malley, the former owner of the Los Angeles Dodgers who moved the team from Brooklyn. But Walter O'Malley had a perspective about what it would be to have a product that was successful for decades. Well, and these folks are only looking at it in terms of what is my profit margin the next 6 months.
Well, let's start, Dave Zirin, with the NFL strike. That lockout, and we should explain it's a lockout, not a strike.
Yes.
That lockout began, I think, in the spring after the NFL draft took place shortly thereafter. And the case, and could you just give just a little bit of the labor history of the league, how we got to this point, and what the union has done specifically in the last few months to deal with the situation?
Well, first of all, it's a very appropriate question you ask, because the first ever president of the NFL Players Association, a former Baltimore Colt named John Mackey, just passed away recently. And so it's appropriate to remember the roots of the NFL Players Association. It started in 1970 after the NFL-AFL merger. And John Mackey, those were two separate football leagues that came together to form one mega league. And it was a huge disparate bunch of players from disparate markets. But it was obvious that the league was going to take off. And John Mackey was a critical, critical player in making the players realize that they were actually on one team and that they had the right to things like free agency and benefits and a retirement plan. And John Mackey, of course, later became a very tragic case study in the violent effects of football, as he suffered the last at least 10, 20 years of his life with frontotemporal dementia, which is a story unto itself.
You know, I wanted to get to this later in the show after we got through the lockout and the union, but I think it's such an important part of these negotiations. It's such a subplot.
It's part of the story.
A part of the story.
I mean, I feel like you can't talk about the current lockout without talking about John Mackey, because, I mean, he's somebody who remains in the minds of so many players, because John Mackey was once known as the smartest guy in the room. That was his nickname, given to him by Jack Kemp, who, of course, became a vice presidential nominee, and who probably no one called the smartest guy in the room, but still.
George W. Bush called him that.
Yeah, I think he might have. That was somebody, in terms of John Mackey, who just impressed people by the power of his intellect and by the power of his conviction. After the players won the strike and after John Mackey actually sued the NFL to eliminate restrictions on free agency, he was drummed out of the league after a Pro Bowl season. He was done. He was punished for his activism. And that makes it so much more like a regular union struggle. And I say that so people realize that, you know, sports, these are actual unions, and these are actual workers, and they are actual families. Yes, it's very different than a typical labor struggle, but it's different for a lot more reasons than just they make much more money than a typical American worker. It's also different because a typical NFL player plays only 3.5 years and dies 20 years before a typical American male. And John Mackey really exemplified and personified the physical sacrifice and the monetary sacrifice of being a proud union football player.
You know, you mentioned John Mackey had dementia. He died of that, and he got early signs of dementia very early in his life. I think in his late 40s.
Yeah.
And this is not especially uncommon among people who play professional football. I know for one, I was raised in Cleveland, where football is the state religion, and I spent much of my youth trying to become a priest. And one of the great football players there, a gentleman named Gene Hickerson, an offensive guard, The tragic story. He basically lived hoping to make the Hall of Fame for the last 20 years of his life. And he finally made it in a vote. But by that point, his dementia caught on so much, he really didn't know what had happened. It was just tragic.
That is tragic. And that's the price that so many of NFL players play. I just interviewed a player who has ALS, otherwise known as Lou Gehrig's disease, which scientists and doctors now believe is linked to excessive concussions. And even Lou Gehrig may have gotten Lou Gehrig's disease because of excessive concussions. And this is what is weighing on the mind of today's player. That's why you can't talk about today's lockout without talking about John Mackey, because one of the things that's radicalized the players so much, and their solidarity has been remarkable through this process. No one expected them to be able to hang on and be as unified as they've been, is the fact that NFL owners came to the table demanding a longer season, despite all we know now about health and safety. They want a longer season, and that just started off these negotiations on a footing where players said to me, like, wow, we're just pieces of equipment to these people.
So it's a lockout, which means that basically the owners don't want to play by the old rules. They want to set up new rules before they allow the game to go on. Is that right?
Yeah, and the players took the owners to court to say that the lockout actually should be deemed illegal and an injunction should be put against the lockout. And the latest court rulings show that these courts, which are stacked with right-wingers, the Eighth Circuit voted 2-1 that the lockout was, in fact, legal. I think the lockout should have been ruled illegal because of they're doing irreparable harm. You know, Bush v. Gore, they're doing irreparable harm to the lives of NFL players precisely because they only have a 3.5-year playing window. But, you know, it's been very interesting to see. Like, I could read you a quote by Troy Polamalu of the Pittsburgh Steelers.
Please
sounds
do.
Like Big Bill Haywood. I can do it off the top of my noggin, unfortunately.
Oh, okay.
But he said, and I'm not paraphrasing that much, he said, people say this is billionaires versus millionaires. That's not it at all. It's about the rich against the rest of us. And if it just happened, this is a struggle that's happening all over the country. And if it just happens to be football players who have to make this stand, then so be it.
Our guest today, who you just been listening to, Dave Zirin, the sports writer for The Nation magazine, who also has the Edge of Sports column. You can find it online at Edge of Sports and the weekly radio program on Sirius XM called Edge of Sports. Dave's joined us before. He's the author of Bad Sports and several other books, and a forthcoming book, The John Carlos Story, which he co-authored with John Carlos. It's an honor to have Dave with us. Now, to our listeners, I should let you know, we're recording this approximately 2 weeks before going on air, and we get a chance to get a hold of it. So don't call in today. Sit back, relax. Let us do the talking. And, Dave, there's a chance that between the time we're recording this program and the time it airs in towards the end of July, that the NFL situation will be resolved, since there's tremendous pressure, as I understand it, on the owners.
Yeah.
The owners need to basically get it solved so they can get their preseason games in, which is this enormous profit cash cow for them, right?
Huge cash cow, because there's no overhead to preseason. And it used to be back in the day, preseason was like a free treat for fans. Well, those days are as dead as fried chicken. I mean, these preseason games are a true cash cow for NFL owners.
They force season ticket owners to buy tickets, right? You have to buy a ticket if you want to get season tickets. You have to buy tickets.
Exactly. They're now folded into season ticket packages. And on top of that, a lot of advertisers are coming up with their fall budgets.
Mm-hmm.
And they need to figure out whether they're going to allocate money for the NFL or not. And if they don't feel like there's going to be a season, they're not going to do that. Like, for example, I go to Baltimore Ravens games. That's my stadium of choice out here. It's relatively affordable. It's a great atmosphere. It's a terrific stadium. And I don't have to cheer for a team called the Redskins. All of those are huge bonuses. And you go to see a Ravens game, and you see Under Armour everywhere. People might know the product, the exercise gear, Under Armour. Now, Under Armour has to decide whether they're going to buy television commercials or underwrite the Ravens stadium. And they have to make that decision. So there is a real pressure on owners to figure this out. There's also pressure on owners because of the broader economic crisis in this country and the real estate crisis. People might know that the Los Angeles Dodgers, the baseball team has had to declare bankruptcy. Gosh, if I'd known that before bad sports, that would have been its own chapter. People might know also that the Texas Rangers declared bankruptcy a year ago. There's a real financial crisis here that's actually rooted in the real estate crisis in the United States. And what owners are dealing with right now is that they have borrowed money on their stadiums, which were publicly funded, to invest. Now, in some cases, those investments have gone sour. In other cases, like with the New York Mets, in other cases, they've expected the wellspring of public subsidies to just frankly never end. And what's the end result of this, Bob, is that there are owners, and I mean this literally, who will go bankrupt if there is no season. Like, they will be ruined. They will have to declare bankruptcy, just like the Dodgers, if there is no season. So that creates a faction of pressure among NFL owners. And I've argued for the last several weeks that the main division right now is not between owners and players at this stage. It's between owners and other owners. That's the holdup to a deal, and I expect it to be resolved by the time your show comes on the air.
Yeah, I do, too. And I think the other point of this, to wrap up on that, is that these teams are all making money, every single one of them. So if they don't play, they actually lose profit. It's not like businesses that are all going under. So if they don't play, they actually come out ahead because they don't lose any more money.
No, that's true.
They're giving up real profits if they don't play. Well, that's one last point on the NFL strike before we go on, Dave Zirin, which is
lockout, Bob.
Lockout. Gosh, thank you so much. See, there I am. I've been watching too much mainstream media.
The
NFL lockout is this question of players' health. And, you know, you look at the sport of football today, and you look at John Mackey and Gene Hickerson, and you look at the concussions, and you look at the health risk that these players take, and it's sort of, you think it's not unlike cigarette smoking. You know, if cigarette smoking were invented today, it'd be made illegal as an obvious health hazard, but a powerful industry exists, so you can't. Would football be made illegal today if someone just came along and invented the sport?
No, because to take cigarettes as the example, it's not just that there's a powerful industry, there's also a powerful market for it. And those create twin pressures. The same way with the NFL. It's not just that there are owners who are profoundly connected politically. It's that it's the closest thing to a national unifying culture that we have in this country.
But my point
is, I don't say that as a complimentary thing, but I say that as a major obstacle to just saying, whoa, this is just too dangerous.
Yeah, but I mean, that's the point. Is there anything that can be done? Is it just a gladiator sport, and you just have to accept that this is a sport in which athletes have to make physical sacrifices with their lives that really would not be considered acceptable if you tried to invent it from scratch. But because it exists, we just look the other way and acknowledge that these athletes are just going to get pummeled.
Well, unfortunately, if you look at things like the rise of mixed martial arts, I mean, I think if it was invented today, I mean, it would absolutely still find purchase, unlike cigarettes, you know, because we do. I mean, look at Antonin Scalia's recent Supreme Court decision about violent video games, where he said that, the state has the right to restrict sex, but not violence when it comes to what kids can watch. I mean, violence is still, you know, there is no Surgeon General warning about violence, but there is about cigarettes.
You know, one thing that the commissioner, Dave Zirin, Goodell, mentioned in passing about a year ago, and I don't know if we talked about this or since the show is less in the air, was possibility that football might get to the point, because I think they're deathly scared of legal problems with all the concussions, that they will have to get rid of the two-point stance and basically have linemen just stand on, or the three-point and four-point stance, and have linemen just standing on their feet and not put their hands on the ground at the line of scrimmage to prevent all the concussions.
No, if you really wanted to do something that was a dramatic change to the rules, I would argue that wouldn't be it, but I would argue changing, I mean, and this is like for a football fan, this is anathema, but it's changing kickoffs and special teams.
Mm-hmm.
Because then you're talking about really, really strong people having, think about it, like a 60, 70-yard head start before hitting somebody.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like, I mean, you know, that's what speed and acceleration and mass produce is concussions. Now, I am one of those people also who does not believe that the sport can be made safer. I mean, we should welcome new technology, but there's the the sort of the Freakonomics argument that says that the better the helmets get, the more concussions are likely because people play not realizing that they're actually hurt.
I don't think there's any doubt about that because rugby has far fewer injuries and these guys
right,
smashing
people
each
are
other.
More likely to lead with their head because of the helmets as well. And I think a lot of people don't realize the science of this. A concussion is basically just a bruise on your brain. That's all it is. Like, so think about how little it takes to, say, get a bruise on your arm. And then think about how tender that part of your arm is and how bad it would be if that bruised part of your arm would be hit over and over and over again. And you begin to get the idea.
Dave Zirin, our guest in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on WILL AM 580. This is a recorded show. We taped it a couple weeks before going on air, so don't call in today. Sit back, relax, and let us do the yakking about the world of sports and sports media and what's going on. And there are a lot of breaking stories. Dave Zirin, of course, a journalist with the Edge of Sports column. You can find it online. He has the Edge of Sports radio show on Sirius XM, and he also writes for The Nation magazine, and you can see him, as you probably often do if you follow the news or sports, on ESPN, MSNBC. You've even been on Fox, haven't you?
That's actually a great question. I have never been on Fox. I've been asked about 7 or 8 times, and honestly, I refuse on general principle because, like you, Bob, I'm a critic of mainstream media. But I think it's very important to get progressive and radical voices on mainstream media. I don't consider Fox to be mainstream media. I consider it to be part of a 50-state Southern strategy and an altogether own media arm of the Republican Party. And I think having voices like mine or yours on Fox is something to do to legitimize the actuality and to put a shadow over the actuality of who they are and what they do and what their intent is. So I don't believe in appearing on Fox on general principle.
Very good. Let's talk about the NBA strike now. Lockout. Gosh, I got to catch myself here. The NBA lockout. The National Basketball Association, its owners locked out the players as of July 1st. And here the situation seems on the surface, from what we can get from the press reports, to be far more ominous than the NFL situation.
Oh, yeah.
It looks like there is a faction of owners who want to go the NHL route. And by the NHL route, I'm talking about actually cancel an entire season to effectively break the union and dramatically lower the money that goes to players. Am I reading this right, Dave Zirin?
You are reading it right, but there are more contradictions at play than in the NHL. Because the NBA has been planning for an NHL-type strategy for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
What they did not plan for was that the 2010-2011 season be a record season for revenues. That was not in their plan. That was not in their projections. $4.3 billion in revenues, the most they've ever had. Fifth highest attendance. Some of the highest television ratings in the history of the playoffs. None of these were considered to be on the table when they were making this kind of battle plan. And so this has done two things, Bob. The first thing it's done is, like in the NFL, it's sowed divisions among ownership. Like those who are saying, hey, this is our time to flatten the union like we've been talking about, and others who are saying, whoa, 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 you know, let's ride this hot hand. The league is actually going somewhere very nice. That's the first thing. The second thing is that because they had their big season, you have a lot of mainstream journalists in left-wing publications like Forbes and Fortune, calling BS on David Stern and the NBA owners who were saying that 23 of their 30 teams lost money last year and that the league as a whole lost $340 million. Now, I'm not prone to give Forbes compliments, but Forbes actually in the past has shown itself to be very, very, very reliable at divining how much teams make, because you have to divine it because, you know, there's so many protections placed on public information, even though so much public money goes to these teams. But Forbes in the past, and we know this because of documents that have been leaked about the finances of teams, Forbes in the past has really nailed these numbers in the past. And Forbes has said, well, wait a minute, actually the NBA made money last year. That's a lie. It did not lose $340 million. And yes, it is true that 17 of the 30 teams, not 23, but 17, did lose money. But then you have to point at the fact that something that the union has been saying, not Forbes, but the union, which is that the NBA does less revenue sharing than any other major sports league. So you have a situation where, yes, 17 of the 30 teams lose money. Even if we accept that, say it's between 17 and 23, let's even say that, you have a situation where the Portland Trailblazers will get $150 million over the next decade as part of their TV deal. The Lakers would get $150 million next year alone. And they don't share this revenue. And so, yeah, then you're going to have haves and have-nots.
And then if you try to create a situation to guarantee that the weakest market and the dumbest owner a profit no matter what, to do that under the current system means you're guaranteeing unbelievably high profits for the top 10 or 15 teams. I mean, that's just absurdly Jed Clampett-type bonanzas.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, is there a chance in the NBA that they would bring in scabs, or do you think they'd just cancel the season?
Yeah, I think they would cancel the season first. I think the idea of bringing in scabs has there's no public appetite for it. It's just difficult, especially in a league like the NBA, which is, you know, like there's no hiding under the helmet like there was in the NFL in 1987. I mean, I cannot imagine a situation where that happened. On the flip side, by the time this broadcasts, we're going to hear about several NBA stars having signed to play overseas. Already Deron Williams, the star point guard for the New Jersey Nets, has signed, or the Brooklyn Nets, tragically, has signed to play in Turkey. And the thing about signing for Turkey or other teams that are connected with what's called FIBA, and that's the International Basketball Association, is that it's written in the FIBA bylaws that if an NBA player plays for a FIBA team, they're immediately released from their contract if there's an NBA lockout or strike that gets settled. So there's no risk by star players to go overseas and make money. And it's a smart labor move as well. It creates more pressure on owners to get something done.
You know, this strikes me as, and this is really an off-the-wall question. No one's talked about it, but on my show, I'm allowed to ask off-the-wall questions. You know, if this did go full throttle and the hardline owners who want to crush the union win, and it's clear they're planning to cancel the season and try to make force the players to give in next summer in 2012, is this an opportunity for some entrepreneur or wealthy individuals or the union themselves to say, basically, do we need these owners? We read Dave Zirin's book, Bad Sports. Yeah. Maybe we can start another league and just get rid of these jokers.
It's so crazy. I mean, like, I've actually gotten that question a lot. And I think the brand of NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball, I think they're just too strong, honestly.
Yeah.
And most of it, of course, is the players. The players bring legitimacy to the brand.
Well, the franchise loyalty is intense. There's no question about it.
Franchise loyalty and the brand itself. Now, my argument has been that owners are superfluous, but the brands, the laundry, as Jerry Seinfeld would say, really isn't superfluous. I mean, if you are a New York basketball fan, you're a Knicks fan, and that's not something that's going to go anywhere. I'd like to see the state of New York or the fans be the owners of the New York Knicks. But the Knicks have to stay the Knicks.
And you're dealing with I know you deal a lot with the NFL Players Union. I don't know how much contact you have with the NBA Players Union. Again, your sense of these unions and their understanding of their relationship with the rest of the labor movement, how advanced is this?
Well, I am very closely connected with the NBA and the NFL Players Association, less so any of the others. And the sense I get is, you know, it's one of those misery loves company moments where there is a real yearning on behalf of the NBA Players Association and the NFL one. That's why they put out the solidarity greetings to the public sector workers in Wisconsin. They want to be seen as part of the broader labor movement. They want to be seen as people who can extend that solidarity to other workers. And I have encouraged friends of mine who are in trade unions or district labor councils, for example, to contact the unions and ask them to send speakers to union meetings, because they'll do that. They will do that. I was at a labor rally of nurses here in Washington, D.C., and a former Washington Redskin named Nolan Harrison spoke at the rally, and it electrified the crowd of about 300 almost entirely female nurses. It was a really cool moment.
Our guest, Dave Zirin. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Again, this is a recorded program, so please don't call in. We taped it, about 2 weeks or so before going on air. We're talking sports, of course, with Dave Zirin, author of Bad Sports, columnist for The Nation, or reporter for The Nation magazine on sports issues, often on MSNBC and ESPN, talking about sports and sports and politics. We've been talking about the lockouts in the NBA and NFL. We're about to move on to some other stuff, but one last question, Dave Zirin. Media coverage of the lockouts. And, you know, you are sort of getting a lot of attention now because you're probably one of the few reporters who's just explicitly sympathetic to the labor in these matters. What's your sense of the lion's share of news media and sports news media coverage of the lockouts so far?
I think it's not uniformly, but it's been largely unspeakably bad. And following the narrative, as the President Barack Obama did, of saying, well, it's billionaires versus millionaires. And not only does that statement completely lack nuance, it's just also not true. I mean, you're not just talking about billionaires versus millionaires. You're talking about some of the richest people in the country, people who have generational wealth, people whose children's children's children will be well taken care of. Going against a workforce of people who almost uniformly come from poor economic backgrounds and who will be out of their sport statistically almost assuredly by the time they're 30 years old and have a tiny, tiny window to make as much money as humanly possible. That's not an equal playing field of rich people squabbling with each other. And anyone who says it is just happy to have athletes as scapegoats as opposed to trying to actually understand where they're coming from.
And you think that how much of a conflict of interest is it, Dave Zirin, that you know, a company like a station like ESPN, which is airs on itself the ESPN channels a number of sports events, so it has close relationships with these leagues and with the owners. Does that undermine their ability to be critical of these leagues?
Well, I think it does. I mean, I think that the financial relationships are so open and out there and intertwined that ESPN can end up being almost like the NFL Network, which is actually a really, really good network in terms of production values and the quality of reporters that they've hired.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, when you have a situation like this, you really see, as I watch the NFL Network, you see that there is a line and that there are limitations to how much they can say. And you know, they do great reporting when it comes to the ins and outs of the game and the strategies or conflicts between coaches and players. But when it comes down to, like, actually criticizing Capital, criticizing the league, criticizing Roger Goodell, I mean, it's non-existent. And ESPN really does pride itself on the line that they say exists between the business side and the journalistic side. And I know enough people there that I can say that I don't have a doubt that that line does in fact exist, but it's a lot easier to have a line when the two sides have nothing to do with each other, when there is no connection, you know. But when that line gets blurry or when that line gets crossed by the realities of the world, then one side has to win out, and you know what? It ain't going to be the journalistic side.
And who are the sports reporters, Dave Zirin, today, be print, broadcast, online, wherever? Who are the ones, or even going back a generation or so, if there aren't that many today, that you read, that you think are really the smart, perceptive people writing about sport in America?
Well, specifically on these issues that we're discussing, I think Sally Jenkins of the Washington Post is a must-read. I mean, she's absolutely fantastic. Also, Jason Reed there at the Post. Kevin Blackstone's stuff, I think, is absolutely fantastic because he's not afraid to talk about politics as he talks about the broader issues that he deals with. And I think that that's a good start for people if they want to just start investigating those folks and find out who those folks read and start mushrooming out from there. That's what I do.
Okay. You know, let's turn to a few topical issues, Dave, that interest me, and I think I'd be very interested to get your take on them. And let's start with college sports. We're here at the University of Illinois, obviously a charter member of the Big Ten, your classic enormous land-grant public university with a strong emphasis on football and basketball and sports. I've taught also at Wisconsin and got my PhD at the University of Washington in Seattle, so I've been affiliated with sort of enormous state universities much of my adult life. And, you know, college sports is an enormous industry, especially the money sports, basketball, men's basketball and football. And, you know, there have been just a number of scandals, again, that have broken in the last year, most prominently at Ohio State University. And it seems like this college academia and sports is a difficult marriage, at least commercial sports. What's your take on this?
I mean, I think that we're completely insane in this country. I think we're certifiable in having our collegiate systems be the effective minor leagues for our professional football and basketball leagues. I think it makes absolutely no sense. What it does is it allows our universities to basically subsidize professional sports and provide this as a service for them to create brands among the incoming talent, so they can be easier sold when they get to a higher level. And, you know, they don't do this for golf. They don't do this for tennis. They don't do this for baseball even. But these moneyed sports, these revenue-producing sports at the college level, I mean, they've become, at far too many schools, like this big sucking sound. Like, it's even ridiculous to call them revenue-producing sports because only about a third of them actually produce revenue. Two-thirds take revenue out because they cost so much to staff and cost so much to fly coaches around for recruiting visits. I mean, it becomes such, all the scholarships, I mean, it becomes such a profound expense that from a cost-benefit analysis, it makes zero sense. And you know who really gets screwed in the end, of course, are the student-athletes themselves. I mean, I spoke to a former NBA player, LaRon Prophet, and he said to me, like, please excise the phrase student-athlete from your vocabulary. At the very best, you can say athlete-student, because once you go on campus, it's no mistake as to what you are there to do.
Yeah, I don't think, Dave Zirin, anyone has been connected with the money sports on a major campus, the top-level football and basketball, would have any doubt about that statement. And to me, it's always been astonishing when students have been able to actually get a really good education and play on football or basketball teams, given the demands in their time and the culture they're in, which puts such overwhelming emphasis upon sports.
Right. No, you're absolutely right about that. That's absolutely correct. There's just no way to do it. So when people say, I mean, just to give people some ammunition out there, when people say, hey, look at the value of the scholarship, you shouldn't pay these athletes, they shouldn't get anything, I would say two things to that. First of all, the value of a scholarship, don't make it over 4 or 5 years, make it over 1 year, because these athletic scholarships are reviewed on an annual basis. Second thing is, they don't get the full use of that scholarship because there are limitations on what classes they can take. There are limitations on what their majors can be. They have coaches telling them to not work too hard in school. I mean, all of these things are disincentives.
What do you think should be, what would be your recommendations? Let's say the head of the NCAA was listening to the show and said, no, this Zirin's a smart guy, and
yeah,
called you up and said they're going to, they want some ideas for how to really reform the system. What would you recommend?
I would say, first of all, start looking in the one ads, because if you're listening to me, they're not going to keep you there very long. the second thing I would say is, look, everybody who plays a Division I sport should get a stipend, whether they're in a revenue-producing sport or not. It should be like work study, because you are selling your campus on the basis of all these remarkable extracurricular activities, and it takes so much of a time investment that to ask people to also have part-time jobs, which, by the way, scholarship athletes are not even allowed to have, or to ask them to do work study or all these other things, I mean, it's just ridiculous. So have it be their work study. Pay everybody 10 hours a week, like stipend, 10 bucks an hour, just for playing the sports. I would also say, look, if you're good enough to get a scholarship, you're good enough to have it for 4 years. So stop this annual review of whether or not athletes get scholarships or not. And the last thing I would say is, look, you need to figure out a plan to get revenue-producing sports, shave off a little tip of what they get. Hell, the television contract alone for the University of Texas football is hundreds of millions of dollars. And they have their own station. I mean, there's got to be a way. I mean, the game is, I would say, look, listen, Mr. NCAA president, the game has changed too much for you to act deaf, dumb, and blind. Woody Hayes, the famous Ohio State football coach, at the height of his powers, made $41,000 a year. Jim Tressel, the disgraced Ohio State football coach, made $3.5 million last year as a base salary alone. Everything has changed except for the fact that the players don't get paid.
And also to put a point, underline that last point, Woody Hayes' peak salary in today's dollars would be approximately $250,000. So it's still then it's 1/12 of what Jim Tressel was making.
Exactly.
Well, Dave Zirin, one other point I want to talk about that's related to this, but really extends to all sports, and it's an issue we've talked about before, is the Madison Avenue commercialization of sport. And we see it at the college sports, but especially at professional sports, where to attend a basketball game today or football game, you almost feel like you're put into an audiovisual shopping mall on steroids.
Yes.
That's
true.
Is this something that that's just the lay of the land, or is this something that can actually be addressed, or is this just sort of just like a mountain range in Colorado, there's not much you can do about it?
I don't think there's anything wrong with fans asking teams to dial down the corporatism a little bit. And they did before. I mean, we're going back about 8 years now, but I remember when Major League Baseball signed a contract with the movie Spider-Man 2 to put spidey webs on every second base. And fans rebelled against that. They're like, look, you can inundate us with ads, but the field itself has to remain pure. And I think that I wish that had been generalized a little bit more by fans who could have said, you know, we really don't need to have to put up with this kind of constant visual assault of all these ads. Because, you know, a lot of people say that sports and politics don't mix, and usually they say it every time an athlete speaks out. But there is a political ethos that surrounds sports. And, of course, it's nationalism, there's patriotism, there's militarism, but there's also corporatism. And this idea that corporate rule is something that people should pay a kind of fealty to. And I don't find it to be an incentive to go to the park, frankly. I like going to NFL games more than NBA games, even though I like the NBA more than the NFL. Because at least in the NFL, it's like an open-air stadium. And it's not this assault of noise and color that's trying to get me to buy at all times.
No, I agree. In fact, I've been going to sporting events for a long time, and they're virtually impossible to go to at the NBA level. It's very difficult. Dave Zirin, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILAM 580. We've got about 10 or 11 minutes left, Dave Zirin. And I'd like to talk now, if we could, about women's sports, and specifically the WNBA, but also the Women's World Cup in soccer. I mean, what's your take, if I could ask you, on the evolution of women's sports in our lifetime? And historically, I think going back to when I was a teenager, when women's professional sports didn't exist except in golf and tennis for the most part. And even there, they were just small potatoes. They barely showed up on the sports page. There has been an impressive growth, specifically in basketball and soccer. But in my mind, it's sort of a stalled out or still has not made the advances I would have thought possible. I just wonder what your take is.
Well, first of all, I mean, it starts with Title IX, and it starts with the explosion of access of women's sports, and the WNBA is entering its 15th year right now. It's a really impressive accomplishment. I would argue that the NCAA Women's Final Four was profoundly, by any measure, statistical or visual, more entertaining than the Men's Final Four. And the Women's World Cup is also, I mean, I think soccer in particular is a sport that women play in a profoundly, I think, pleasing and entertaining fashion. I think that women's sports suffers for two reasons, and I think you're right to point out that it doesn't seem click like it otherwise would or should. One of those reasons is, just sexism in the culture and sexism about women's sports. There's a great book called The More Women Have Voices, The More Popular Football Is. I'm getting the title wrong, but the point is that you get the point of it, though. It's like men tend to be much more covetous of men's sports as women get more of a voice in the broader culture. And I really do think that's a part of it. A second part of it, which I don't think should be shunted aside at all, is the people who organize and run women's sports. I mean, the idea of appealing to a cheesecake demographic and having women athletes pose for things like Playboy's Women of the Olympics issue or Maxim magazine. I mean, Mary Jo Kane did studies on this at the Tucker Center at the University of Minnesota and shows, using very, very impressive empirical data, that by doing that kind of like sexing up of women's sports, what you do is you actually repel the audience for women's sports. I mean, it's very good at selling magazines, but very bad at creating a loyal fan base.
What is the fan base for women's sports? What does the research show? Is it largely women?
No, it's two huge factors of people, both turned off by the sexy bikini stuff. One is women, as you'd imagine, and the other is men with daughters, because it's seen as, and this is a comment about men, I think, but, you know, women's sports is seen as a safe space to bring your daughter and bond and communicate and all the rest of it. And men with daughters also tend to be very turned off by the over-sexual stimulation that they try to produce with women's sports, and specifically the advertising for women's sports.
When we look at the Women's World Cup in soccer, as you said, some extraordinary sport for those interested in soccer. It also draws the question is, you know, why hasn't soccer become a more prevalent or prominent sport in the United States as a professional spectator sport? It hasn't really gone anywhere compared to the number of people who play the game here.
Well, I mean, it's so funny because there is that joke that says soccer will always be called the future sport of the United States. And yet it is the most popular youth sport in the United States. The U.S. just played Mexico in Southern California, and they sold out the Rose Bowl. I mean, there is a huge soccer audience, a huge, especially as the United States becomes more multicultural, a huge reservoir of soccer fandom. If anything, we don't do better at soccer in this country on the international stage. And that is, I think, a prerequisite to popularity, especially in America, is you got to win. Because if you can't win, it somehow delegitimizes the sport if the U.S. isn't the best at it. But I think it's still about how narrow the talent sluice is, because we still draw our soccer players from much more elite suburban backgrounds. When if you're somewhere like Brazil, I mean, it's the sport of the poor, which makes sense because it's a very easy sport to play. And I think that's a prerequisite. You know, Joe DiMaggio once said, if you want to be a champion in the Major League Baseball, you got to grow up poor, because no one who's had hunger in his belly can be stopped. And a lot of our soccer players that we get in the U.S. Have less hunger in the belly than are more kind of fattened up by the time they get to that top level.
So do you think, Dave Zirin, that if, for example, in 2014 or whatever, 2018, the United States somehow made it to the finals of the World Cup or even won, that could even trigger a huge upsurge of interest in the sport in the country?
I think it would. Absolutely, I think it would. I mean, I was down, I remember, at NPR doing a show when the U.S. was playing Britain in a very, very, very exciting game. And people were glued. People were just glued to the TV set. And it can have an energy and a buzz that can draw in even the most resistant fan. And I think most people who resist soccer haven't ever watched it, to be honest with you, and male or female. And speaking of this, I really do think it's much more about the U.S., its place in the world, and winning. I mean, you see that all the time. Like, every time the World Cup goes around, with almost like a monotonous regularity, you have the troglodytes of the radical right on talk radio talking about soccer like it's a socialist sport, and, you know, and this is a sport. I mean, this past year, I believe it was Glenn Beck saying that, Obama likes soccer because Obama wants the U.S. to have living standards like the third world. As if Barack Obama's in the White House saying, you know what we need? Third world living standards across this country. You know, it's just, it's like it's part of, it's a sport of the other, of brown people, even despite its popularity in, you know, Europe, of course. But it's like, so that's used as a way to delegitimize it. But I would argue that if the U.S. was kicking butt in the World Cup, Glenn Beck would be wearing red, white, and blue cleats.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about it. Dave Zirin, our guest today in Media Matters. I am your host, Bob McChesney. Only got a couple minutes left. This is a recorded show, so I hope you haven't been trying to call in. And I'd like to close with one of your recent columns, Dave Zirin, which I really enjoyed reading, which was an episode where you talked about Robert Lipsight, the sort of one of the giant sports writers of the past 50 years in the United States. And he was present at a meeting of the Beatles and Muhammad Ali, sort of surreal story about sort of pop culture icons. All that was missing was Elvis or Marilyn Monroe. To recount that story, if you would.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's in Bob Lipsight's book. I've also interviewed Bob Lipsight about it, and it's a really terrific memoir called An Accidental Sports Writer. And Bob Lipsight was sent down as a very young man, 26 years old, to cover Muhammad Ali against Sonny Liston when Muhammad Ali was known as Cassius Clay, and was also thought that he was going to be destroyed by Sonny Liston. And the only reason Bob Lipsight got this plum historic assignment, one of the most famous bouts in sports history, was because the boxing writer of the New York Times didn't want to go because he thought it would be so boring. And he thought, you know, all you got to do is go down to the hospital and wait for Cassius Clay to show up with all his injuries from Big Sonny. But, of course, one of the reasons why everybody so misjudged and underestimated Cassius Clay was because of the generational gap. And not just about, it wasn't just about race, it wasn't just about just culture, black and white. I mean, it was about generational culture. And Bob Lipsight, being 26, got how cool Cassius Clay was. And the Beatles showed up, and Bob Lipsight got kind of like pushed into a dressing room with the Beatles while they were waiting for Cassius Clay to come. And the Beatles were this was on their first tour of the United States. This was on the big British invasion, and they were supposed to do something with Sonny Liston, but Sonny Liston said he didn't want to be seen on have pictures taken of him, as he put it, with those sissies. So it was pretty intense. And then Cassius Clay comes in and immediately sort of got the Beatles, got that they were, you know, like him, just kind of like ironic people. And with winking at the cameras, and they clowned around in the stage, and it became this remarkable moment of pop cultural symmetry, like the 60s before the 60s. And then after the Beatles left and everybody hugged, Cassius Clay looked around and said, who were those guys?
You know, though, it's part of the story I had heard that wasn't in Lipsight's book, so maybe my part's urban legend, was that Clay had no idea who the Beatles were, and someone explained how rich they were, how much money they had made at all their hits, and he looked at them and said, you guys aren't as dumb as you look. And John Lennon looked back at him and said, yeah, but you are.
Yep, that is part of that is true. I've heard that in every rendition.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Dave Zirin, on that wonderful note, let's conclude this episode of Media Matters. I want to thank you for taking time out of your schedule to visit us. And good luck with your work. We'll have you back with John Carlos, I hope, in the fall when the book comes out.
Oh, my privilege. I look forward to it.
And I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank you all for listening, everyone. I want to thank the staff at WILL AM 580, and I'll be back with you in 167 hours. Goodbye, everyone. We'll be right back.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
We'll have a chance of showers and thunderstorms with us through the day and into tonight. Otherwise, we'll have a high near 93. The heat index could get up as high as 107 this afternoon, and an excessive heat warning remains in effect until 7 o'clock this evening. Then it'll be less humid, a low near 71 tonight, tomorrow mostly sunny, a high near 90. This is WILL, AM 580 and FM 90.9, HD3 Urbana.